Welcome to From the Library with Love, a podcast for anyone whose life has been changed by reading. Janet Skeslin-Charles is the award-winning author of Moonlight in Odessa and the Paris Library. She learned about the history of the American Library in Paris whilst working there, and it went on to inspire her New York Times best-selling novel. The Paris Library has been phenomenally successful, topping the bestseller charts, and it's been translated into 35 languages. It's my huge pleasure to welcome Janet.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
Oh, I'm so happy to have you here. We had a few false starts, didn't we? My fault entirely, because I had editor's neck. And now you're in the thrust of your editing, aren't you?
Indeed.
So I'm going to just dive straight in and talk about the Paris Library, which is easily one of my all-time favourite novels of recent times. I devoured it in just one hungry gulp. And I was trying to think like why that is. And I think it's a rare book that can transport you so effectively into the heart of an occupation or the time frame that it's set in. But you managed it so convincingly, I could almost taste like that sort of smoky Parisian air. And so let's just start by, if you don't mind, by telling us about the premise of the book and the inspiration behind it.
Well, thank you, Kate, for your kind words. I felt the same about the little wartime library. I loved it so much.
Oh, bless you.
The characters. And as someone who worked in the library, I thought you did an amazing job of showing not just the idyllic version of libraries, but, you know, the actual problems that female librarians do
right.
have to deal with.
Right, because they are frontline workers, aren't they, as you will know.
They really are. And so I love that. Well, the Paris Library began when I worked at a library here in Paris. And I heard this story about these amazing librarians who resisted during World War II. And so I knew that I wanted to tell that story. So I started researching in the evenings and on weekends and just became absolutely fascinated with the story. Online, I found a report marked confidential written by the directors of the library. And it was about the time right before the occupation and then during the occupation. And I knew it was a novel. And so I sat down to write it.
And there's nothing like having confidential stamped on something to make you want to pick it up, right? That's straight away just like, oh, I have to look in that. Oh, it was so, it was just wonderful. And your research was meticulous as well, and I feel like you're a real story magpie. You're a little bit like me. You sort of swoop around in the past looking for anything that sort of glimmers a bit. Tell me how you went about that research.
Well, I randomly called people with the last name of my real life characters, and so I ended up talking to the descendants of some of the librarians.
You're joking. I didn't know that.
And so I had lunch with the son and daughter of the librarian who was shot through the lung by the Gestapo. And they told me that he had a complete recovery, never stopped smoking his beloved Jeton cigarettes.
Well, he is Brent.
Librarian until retirement. So I talked to another librarian. There was a library love story where two of the librarians married and had children. So I talked to their daughter who lives in Greece now. And she was actually really helpful because we had some photos, and so she could identify who was in the photos.
Oh.
So there was another character I didn't write about, but I ended up talking to her descendants as well. And it was just really wonderful to be able to talk to these people and kind of make that history alive again.
So you were literally going through the French phone book, you know, and then anyone who had a similar surname, just cold calling them saying, hi, I'm writing a book.
Yes, absolutely.
I love that.
Absolutely, yes. And also,
that's like the opening of a film.
And the grandson I contacted on Facebook. So yes, and LinkedIn, yes.
So did you have a book deal at that point, or were you just writing it for you almost, for the love of it? I can't remember what came first.
No, I will always write the book before I submit it. I would be very fearful of just submitting a synopsis. I had a friend who did that, and when he handed in the book, his editor said this wasn't what we ordered and
didn't want to publish
it. So I just, to kind of avoid that situation where you just want to make sure that what the editor wants, the editor has for them.
So you sort of wrote, as I read this wonderful quote in a Stephen King memoir when he wrote about writing, that he always writes the first draft as if the door is shut. So no one, as if no one's ever going to read it. It's just you, yours and yours alone, which is,
Yes,
I feel like, the best way to write a book.
I think so. I think so, yes. I don't think I could write on. I know a lot of people just write a just can write a synopsis and sell it on the synopsis, but at that point in my career, I
Yeah.
don't think I had the reputation to be able to do that.
Yeah. But how wonderful, there you were going through your phone book and then writing your characters, not knowing that it's going to be in 35 countries. I mean, it's been so successful. Has that, did that take you by surprise? I mean, or how did you feel about all that?
You know, my goal was actually 40. My goal was actually 40.
Was it?
So yeah, it was 40. It still is 40. So, but I have an illegal version in Iran. So
Oh,
that probably goes
really?
to 36. So we will see. You know, my first book, Moonlight in Odessa, which is about the booming business of email order brides, sold in I think 14 countries. So I knew about the possibility of foreign rights when I was writing this
Okay,
book, and I
okay.
figured that people would be interested in World War II.
So you're 35/36, one illegal, but the next one's going to top 40. I know
We'll see.
it. So tell me, let's talk about characters, if you don't mind, because they're really vivid and well drawn and really, oh, believable, but they are real people to me. That's how it felt. And I'm always puzzled as an author how people achieve that extra level with characters. And I remember listening to a really interesting interview with Jojo Moyes, who wrote The Giver of Stars, which is another sort of librarian book. She wrote about the horseback librarians in Kentucky, which is a brilliant book. And she said that when she's writing her characters, she subjects them to like a stress test. And I was fascinated by this. She tries to imagine what her characters would do if they saw a stranger kicking a dog in the street. Like, how would they react? She puts them in situations that they won't face in the book to see how they react. And then she tries to imagine things like, what would they have in their handbag? You know, really adding extra layers. How did you get to know your character?
Well, you know, my characters, just life was a big stress test for them. It was these real life
Right, the
characters,
occupation.
you know, with the occupation, dealing with Nazis and all of these problems that they faced. Their life was stressful enough, and so my job was kind of to give them moments of calm where they could actually sit down and read a book before going out and facing all of the stress of the occupation and of the expectations. You know, my main character's name is Odile, and she's a young woman, and so her parents are expecting her to get married. They're expecting her to bring home suitors, and she has a best friend who's very glamorous, and it's very hard on Odile. Feels a lot of jealousy towards her best friend. So for me, I tried to give her some grace because
That's a
she's
lovely
very
way of
young
putting it.
and very impetuous, like a lot of us are when we're young. And so that was maybe instead of putting them through more, I tried to put them through less.
Oh, I love that. I love that. And I did actually, now you say that, I can sense there were moments where you had her sitting under, I think it was under a weeping willow tree, and the waters of the Seine were swirling around her, and it was like a moment of calm. I do remember that. But another scene that was so vivid, and I always find this is the mark of a really well written book, that you still remember certain scenes years on. And there was that scene in your book towards the end, after the liberation, when one of the characters is walking, I think, down by the Tuileries, I think it was, and they remember seeing a woman who had been accused of collaboration with a German, and she was being and she was escorted by this sort of angry mob, wasn't she? And they were beating drums, and it was just it really grabbed me. I had to put the book down because I knew that these scenes were based on true things. Can we talk a little bit around that? Because the level of vitriol towards women accused of collaboration, did that surprise you?
I have to say, nothing surprises me about how men will treat women. I'm
Yeah.
very sorry to say, but I think, you know, and they even called it horizontal collaboration. So they were accusing these women of sleeping with the German soldiers, even if the women were barmaids who just were or waitresses All of a sudden they were collaborators, all of a sudden they were enemies. And I think it was very painful. And when I was writing this book, I was looking at a lot of photos. There was a big national museum here in Paris that had an exhibit on hair. And part of that exhibit, they showed films of these women getting their hair shaved in the public square. And they are the women in French are called les tondues, or and so like the shaven, so they actually have a phrase.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Documentaries of interviews with these women in the 80s and 90s, and none of them, even if it was 30 or 40 years later, they would not face the camera. So they
Really? Because the
still
level
have
of
that
shame.
shame so many years
I
later.
find
And
it.
they, yeah, no, it was really, I think that's the thing that surprised me the most, was that they could
Right.
never say, this happened to me in a moment of national anger and frustration, and I did not deserve this. They weren't able to do that. And I mean, they still didn't forgive themselves, and they still felt such shame.
That's heartbreaking to hear, isn't it? Because often, if a woman had a relationship with a German, it didn't mean that she was a collaborator. It meant she was a young woman, who was just acting as young women do. There are very few
Exactly.
women that acted off a sense of sympathy for their ideology.
And there were many resistance who women who were working for the resistance, but they were their families were forced to have German soldiers billeted in their homes. And so because of that, there was this gaze upon them as if they were as if these women were guilty of something when they weren't.
The
So
level of
still,
misogyny that
yes, it was really something.
I heard a phrase, the occupations inject poison into the areas upon the neighborhoods upon which are occupied, and it really rung true to me because I experienced a similar thing when I was researching the wartime book club set in occupied Jersey, and Jersey was nowhere near on the scale of France, but the women that were accused of collaboration there, they were known as jerry bags, which is just such a horrible phrase. And a similar-ish thing happened after liberation, that a woman was chased down the street and very publicly stripped of her clothes, and they were going to hang her from a lamppost had it not been for the British soldiers who intervened. But something about that really lives with me, and I hate that feeling. And I actually remember a tour guide said to me that memories are so long when it comes to occupation. And he was explaining how an elderly lady, I think in her 90s, went into a care home recently in Jersey, and all the women in the room just deliberately turned their backs on her because she was a jerry bag, even all these years on. And I find that so heartbreaking. There's just something about that that really touched me. And I just, so yeah, it really stood out to me in your book, that intense hatred and vitriol, but it really does reveal the climate of the times, doesn't it? And this potency of that anger and what it must be like to live through a collaborate through a occupation.
And how will you treat that in this novel that, so many years later, is that something that you will write about in your author's note or?
Yeah, no, I have, and in fact, I have. One of my Obviously, my protagonist, her sister, is having a relationship with a German, not because she's got any Nazi ideology or sympathies, but because she was a young 17-year-old woman. There was no other men around, really. So she just, she fell in love. And I do reference that years on in the market, she still spat on. And I hope to just not paint it as a definitive black and white picture, but just cast a bit of light and shade onto it and nuance and explore those issues around it. And why it is that women, so often women, are the ones that are targeted and filled with shame and all that hatred that still exists all these years on. It's a very inflammatory issue today. It's still all these years on in Jersey, that issue of jerry bags. And I did an interesting tour actually with a tour guide around St. Helier, and he was showing me all the places where, so when a woman had had an affair with a German or was rumored to have had an affair, probably half the time it's just like in France where they were billeted, they would paint a tar swastika on the outside of the woman's home. And if you go around Jersey, you can still see the faint outlines. They've been whitewashed over, but you can still see the faint outlines of swastikas. So history is always there, just below the surface, isn't it?
That is really fascinating. I would love to go to Jersey and to Guernsey, just the
Yeah.
four dream destinations.
I think you would find it really interesting, especially with your knowledge of the French occupation. And there was resistance, of course, weren't there? I mean, I always find it really interesting, and this is what I found in your book, that librarians are often overlooked for their resistance, which in many ways was kind of softer and more subtle. Can you tell us a bit about the resistance at the American Library?
Well, the libraries, well, in Paris, for example, Jewish people were not allowed to go into parks. They weren't allowed to take classes. They weren't allowed to cross the Champs-Élysées. They had to sit in the last metro car, and they weren't allowed into libraries. I think in the National Library, they had a room set apart for them. So what the American Library in Paris did was they had librarians who delivered books to patrons. And so that was the way that they got around that room lane
Yeah.
was, and to make sure that all the patrons remained part of the fabric of the library.
And that, I mean, had your character been found for doing that, that would have a clear breach of German rule. You know, they would have been
Yes,
arrested by the SS and
I think it would have been really scary because they would have had to go through the Germans were always had their barricades and you had to go through. And so I think the librarians had to memorize the addresses. I don't think they'd want a piece of paper with the address on them. So they would really have to think about how to get to these homes without saying where they were going
yeah, because I remember
being followed.
yeah, your protagonist having to stop at a roadblock and just having the act of having a book, you know, that was subversive enough, wasn't it, under German occupation, particularly if it wasn't the right kind of author or a band.
Yes,
Were a
well,
lot
and
of books banned?
with the auto list, there were a lot of books
Ah.
banned. So yes, it was a really challenging time for librarians and book lovers.
And I presume the books banned were sort of Jewish authors, communists, anybody that spoke out about the regime.
Yes, but also a few books by Hemingway, I think, were on the auto list,
Yes,
and a
yeah, he
few,
was a banned author.
so yes.
Yeah, often quite surprising authors. I remember that the man who wrote Bambi, his book was apparently banned as well. I don't know, just random books that they took huge offense to. It would not have been easy to fall foul of the Third Reich, though, would it?
No, Bambi, that is very interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I've used it as the in the wartime book club. Each chapter heading has a banned book or a book that fell foul of the Nazis, and he was a Jewish author who then went on to sell the rights to Bambi to Disney for a very derisory sum of money, and it was very sort of Disneyfied, and obviously it's massive now. And this poor Jewish author died penniless, I think, in Switzerland after the war. So yeah, it was a that was that that fell foul of them. But in all this talk of occupation, do you ever think, like, have you ever thought, how would you have fared under an occupation?
In my book, what the research said was in the New York, the Paris edition of the New York Herald, the American ambassador put something in the paper that basically said, leave the country now. And I always thought, if an ambassador tells me to leave, I will definitely be on that first ship home. But when COVID happened in March of 2020, I was in the States, I was home. And yet I got on a plane to come back to France. And so that kind of surprised me because I always thought if there's trouble, I will just go back to the States.
Yeah.
And yet I was there and I chose to come to Paris. So I think that that's just a small example to say that we never know
We don't know
in
how
our
we'll react.
lives what we know what we'll do, but when the time comes, we just don't know.
So let's talk a bit, if we can, Janet, about in England, there was this huge sort of propaganda campaign called Reading for Victory, which I've always fascinated by because there were lots of other campaigns, you know, like Make Do Amend and Beauty is Your Duty. But Reading for Victory was a campaign that wasn't particularly well known, but was quite entrenched, I think, in World War II. And I believe that the Ministry of Information very quickly realized that it would boost that all important morale during World War II. And yet, for women seeking solace and escape and sanctuary in times of danger and privation, it went much deeper. Why do you think reading was so important to wartime women? What sense did you get researching the Paris Library about that? Particularly books like romantic fiction and historical fiction seem to be very popular.
I think if we look at the little wartime library and we see all of those people in the tube underground and also in the Paris library in the military hospitals where there were these long, long, big rooms where men just were, just inches apart from each other in the beds, just like the Londoners were in the tube, the books provided a privacy of the mind. where they
Oh, that's
were
a lovely way of putting
physically
it.
surrounded by people where they couldn't escape, they couldn't move on, but the books allowed them to escape, and they allowed them to be somewhere else when maybe they didn't want to be in that hospital bed, or they didn't want to be underground with all those smells,
That's such a
that danger above ground. So yes, I think it's the privacy of the mind that it offers.
I love that. That's such a good way of putting it, privacy of the mind, because actually that's exactly what it is. You know, it's pressing, and it's sort of pressing pause, isn't it, on the lonely churn of your thoughts. Like I remember in COVID, I read all the time because everything around you was so uncertain and you never knew what would happen from one day to the next. It gave me a permission to switch off and just escape out of the world. And I guess that must have been what it was like in Paris and or if underground at Bethnal Green when the world is chaotic and frightening and uncertain.
Like it's so
How did you
threatening.
feel about reading in COVID?
I think I'm reading more now than I did in COVID. In COVID, what was I doing? I was working on this book, and it was because Paris is very noisy. People don't realize how noisy Paris is because it's just, and maybe it's like London. There's just constant renovation, the constant need to
Always.
redo the water pipes, to redo the electricity
But they're
pipes,
old
to redo
cities, aren't they, with
roads.
ancient plumbing? So I
So
guess, yeah.
yes, in my neighborhood, it was the first time in a really long time that the jackhammers stopped. In Paris, the facades of buildings have to be cleaned every few years. And so there's always scaffolding going up and going down. So the clank of the scaffolding, the whiz of the water, the men talking while they're working. So it's very noisy. And so COVID was so quiet that it was a time that I actually was working on this book that's going to come out in May of 2024, doing that research. Putting those things together.
That must have been absolutely delicious, is probably the only word, to have that quiet. Because you don't realize, do you? I realized in COVID, because we have a lot, we're under a flight path, so the planes go over all the time. And suddenly I was like, what's that noise? And I thought, I live near the river. And I thought, my God, I can hear the water lapping. And I had never heard it because of the planes.
Yes.
And that sense of like very clear air, because the planes and the traffic had stopped, the air felt sweet. I have to say, that was one side of it that I really enjoyed.
Yes, no, the quiet. So I really enjoyed that. I just did a lot of research and things like that. And recently I've decided to read more fiction, and I've been trying to put reviews up on Goodreads because I feel like there's
Oh,
so
well
many
done.
people out in the world kind of putting out negative reviews, or without even reading the book, they'll write did not finish, 1 star. And so I've been trying to read more and to put
You're
out
a good
fiction
reads
vibes in the
fairy.
world. There we go.
I love that you're out there putting good back into the world, because Goodreads can be quite a vitriolic place at
Yeah, I
times,
mean,
can't it? Or who knew that you're out there trying to, remove the toxicness and put the wonder back.
or at least like paint over it.
Do you read your own reviews?
I do. I'm kind of interested in what people say, and I think it's some of them I think are really insightful. The
Yeah,
ones
for
like A
sure.
Taste of Time, it's really a young woman wrote me, her teacher had her reach out, had the class, each of the students reach out to an author. And so to read those insightful words from people who've really taken the time to read
Yeah.
your work, it's really inspiring because I have a really hard time talking about why I love a book. It's like, why do I love my husband? Because I do. You know what I mean? And so
Yeah.
to put into words something that you can't really, it's a feeling that I find it very
Quite a
hard to write
skill,
down.
actually, isn't it? Writing
Yeah,
a
it
good
really
review.
is.
And when
Really.
somebody has got the ability to put it down and just verbalize what it is they love about a book, you can learn a lot from that. And you can learn a lot from the bad reviews as well. I mean, I've talked about this in other podcasts, but one review I love research so much, and I do remember I probably overdid it. And I remember reading one review where somebody said, "Oh, Thompson's really done her research, and doesn't she want us to know it?" But it did, you have to learn from things like that. If she felt that, then maybe I was being too heavy-handed with the research and the history of it.
Well, but I think she's got it wrong in that, it's so interesting. That's the thing. We find it so interesting. We wouldn't do it if we didn't think it was interesting. And these people's lives that we're reading about, we want to share those details. So I think it's more about excitement and enthusiasm than wanting to show the world, oh, I know this.
Yeah, I wasn't trying to be a smarty pants, top of the class. I find it all so
Exactly. Those
fascinating.
details are fascinating, and these people, what these people
Yeah.
went through and lived through,
Yeah.
is fascinating.
And on the subject of that, because I love the details, I love the visceral element of the past. Like, and I got that very much from your book, the smell of glue and paper and what things felt like and tasted like and what they sounded like. And I've talked about this in other podcasts as well, but people do think, my husband especially thinks I'm really weird, because when I was researching the wartime library, I was chatting to a librarian in Exeter and she said, "Oh, you want to come and visit our Blitz book?" And during World War II, Exeter Library was bombed very badly during the Blitz, and the whole, it was a firestorm, it got a direct hit, and one book survived the Exeter Blitz. And she said, "You must come down, we keep it in our vault." So I got the train, traveled 300 miles to smell this book, and she was right. And when I lifted the book up, it still smells of Blitz fires. I was so fascinated by this, that how this book sort of wears its perfume from that night. It was a sort of brackish, damp smell, but it really took me straight back there. So how do you sort of summon the smells and the sounds of the past? How do you feel your way into it?
Oh, that's a good question. I really play around with it. I do smell a lot of things. I do feel a lot of things because I do want the textures. I do want the
Yeah.
smells. But it's really, yes, I think it's just like what you said. You can't do too much because then it feels mechanical, but you have to do enough to make people feel as if they're there.
Yeah. Because quite often that just one little detail can be enough to just to time hop you back sort of 80 years, can't it? So books about books and books in libraries and bookshops, basically anything like books about books, have such a, they're a genre in their own right now. And I feel like you pioneered it really with the Paris Library. Why do you think they have such a hold on our heart?
Well, I think there's so many books out there, like the Little Wartime Library, The Giver of Stars, Bookwoman of Troublesome Creek. So I think people are finally realizing that librarians are heroes. And I think one way we see that, at least in the United States, was through the Patriot Act, which under Bush, the government wanted librarians and public libraries to hand over people's Google searches. Or to hand over people's searches to find out if they were looking at, in the aftermath of 9/11, to find out if people were looking for things like, how to build a bomb or how to,
Wow.
start a fire or, different things that could harm communities. And so librarians resisted and said there's no way that they would hand over that.
I had no idea about that. Did that really happen in the wake of 9/11?
It was part of the Patriot Act.
God, that's mind blowing. So that sort of neatly leads on to another question I had, because the obviously in your book and mine, we both explore themes of censorship, which seems to be rearing its head again. This seems to be very prevalent in the news right now about censorship. Why do you think we're seeing it again? Do you think we're actually seeing it again? Is this a manufactured sort of story by the media, or is it the case that there are more banned books and
Well, there are
more
definitely
complaints?
more banned books. The American Library Association has tracked numbers of banned books for many, many years. And I think the last few years, the requests to ban books have doubled every year. And I think what we're seeing is fear. People are afraid. The world is turning faster and faster, and some people really have a problem with that. And you see that in the subjects of the books that are banned. When I was growing up in the 80s, the books that were banned were about sex. So you had parents who were afraid their kids were going to have sex. And later on, it's about like lesbian or gay issues. Later on, it's about transgender issues. Later on, it's about anti-racism. So every book that's banned, you can really see the fear behind it. I wish that parents would read the books with their kids and talk about it and talk about their fears instead of going out into the
Yeah.
communities or statewide or nationwide saying no one should read this book,
Yeah.
probably often never having read the book themselves. And I think we have it. I think kids are learning so much on the internet. I mean, with so much on the internet, but it's impossible to censor the internet. And so what can people censor? They can censor libraries and they can yell at a librarian. And so librarians find themselves on the front line of this cultural war every day. And it's very challenging. It's really, really frustrating.
For sure. And you're right. You're right. Fear is what underpins it. What do you think a deal would have made of the censorship? your
think
protagonist.
I think she would have understood the fear behind it, and I think she would have encouraged parents to read the book and talk to their children about it. And I think, my parents, I can remember my dad finding my copy of Forever by Judy Blume. And Judy Blume said her daughter asked Judy Blume to write that book, and she just wanted a book where nothing catastrophic would happen if the kids had sex. And so that's what the book basically is a couple of teenagers who have sex and nothing bad happens. But I think parents are so afraid, or were so afraid, and we see that with, with suicide as well. There are books that talk about suicide, and so instead of having those conversations about these issues, we're seeing people just want to ban those books as if that will get rid of the issue.
Yeah, when in reality, you shut down that original thought. You're not getting rid of the problem. It's just festering and going to become more explosive down the line, isn't it? It's sad in a way, though, isn't it? Do you find it sad? Because we write about censorship under a totalitarian regime and all the darkness and all that we knew became of that, to see it occurring under a different format, but 80 years on. But then I suppose human nature doesn't change, doesn't it? The fears are still there.
No, and I think it's easier for people who want to ban books. I think it's very easy for them now to organize with the internet. It's so much easier to send out emails. It's so much easier to send out tweets. It's so much easier to create Facebook pages. Yes, I think that's what I find is saddest, is instead of talking about books that they do enjoy or would recommend, it's always talking about books that they haven't read and that they don't want anyone to read.
Yeah, I feel like everybody's very quick to give their opinion these days as well, aren't they? As if their opinion is super valid and therefore they're going to shout about it on every forum possible. We seem to have lost the ability for discourse, for reasoned thought, for sitting and listening to and then agreeing to disagree, rather than just, I don't like that book, so I don't want you to read it either. So interesting, all that subject. Moving back to writing again, though, where's your comfort zone? Is it in writing or research? What do you prefer? Where's the bit where you think, oh, I really love doing this? I'm in my
Probably
happy
like my
place.
first draft before anyone's really seen it, or if I meet with a writing group and just exchanging those first drafts and talking about the
Oh,
possibilities.
you
I think
do
that's
work
what
with
I
a writing
really,
group, do you?
yes, and I really enjoy that. Yes.
Yeah, when no one else's eyes are on it, it's all yours,
Yes,
and you've still got the
exactly. The
possibility.
enthusiasm, all the possibilities.
That's fascinating to hear you work with a writing group. How does that work? Do you share your work with each other and then give your opinions? How does that work?
Well, we just maybe exchange 10 pages, sometimes once a month, sometimes every other week, depending. And then we just talk about those chapters. And I find that a lot of times when I'm having trouble with my own dialogue or with my own settings or things like that, I can't see it. But if I look at someone else's work in progress, I'll say, oh, wow, boy, they're having a
Oh,
lot of trouble
yeah.
with their dialogue. And then I look back at my own and I see I'm having the exact same issues. And for some reason, I can see it clearly in someone else's and I can't see it in my own. So actually, when you look at someone's work where it's really interesting, but it isn't quite there yet, a lot of times at least I find parallels in my own work on things that can be improved. And it's really gratifying. I worked with a woman who did a memoir over the course of 5 years, and it was just absolutely fascinating, so gratifying to see her answer all the questions that she had, to go deep into her family, to go deep into her past, each draft, more and more profound about things. And it's very, not just for your own work, but to see other people create such beauty over the course of a few years, it's incredible.
Yeah. And how much do you plot in advance, don't it? Are you a plotter or a panster, as they call it? How do you tend to work?
For this new book that I'm working on that comes out in May of 2024, I have not plotted enough, clearly. And it's bringing me big problems now. And I feel like it's good to at least plot a little bit, which I have done in my previous books, where I'll have at least an outline of what needs to happen. And with this book, I don't know why I resisted plotting. I just let the character kind of reveal herself. I think it's challenging when you work with real life characters. This book is about the American Committee for Devastated France, which is a group of women, 350 women who came to France from England, Canada, and the United States. And there were a lot of French women in the group as well. And they rehabilitated northern France, 90% of which had been completely devastated. And so I'm dealing with all of these amazing women. And for some reason, I just maybe didn't want to tell them what to do, or I was hesitant about, I just maybe wanted them to reveal
You were
themselves
their library assistant.
rather than me cracking the whip, telling them what to do. So, but I think if there are people, if there are beginning writers out there listening to us today, I would say it does help to have a bit of a, it does have to have a bit of an outline for your chapters.
What period of the World War I are we talking about? Towards the end or in the
So
middle?
they started in 1916. They were 40 miles from the front, and a French
Wow,
general
so close.
allowed them to live on the in the ruins of a chateau. And they started right away rehabilitating the farmland so that the villagers could come back and work their land. France was this part of France was occupied by the Germans for 3 years, and it was a more brutal occupation in a lot of ways than the Second World War was.
Really?
When I was researching World War II, I came along the phrase that the Germans must be correct in terms of behavior. Their superiors were always telling the young Nazis, be correct, meaning have proper behavior. And that's because during World War I, the behavior was so atrocious. And so the ones that were leading in World War II were there already in World War I and saw what happened and how horribly the German soldiers behaved.
I had
And
no idea. I had never heard of
so
that.
it was, yes, they enslaved women and children. They just it was a really vile situation. There were no men because the men were either really old men, or the men were fighting, or the men had died fighting. So it was a very hard time for the French women, who had to take care of the farm, take care of the house, take care of the businesses they might have, teach the children. It was a really, really challenging time for these French women. And so
But who were also being subjugated and
yes,
enslaved by the sounds of it.
for
I had
years. And so,
never heard of that.
yeah.
Why do you think World War I as a area for fictionalization doesn't seem to have had quite the same prominence as World War II? And yet, as you've proven, it's a rich vein of stories, isn't it? I mean, to uncover.
Fascinating. No, it's absolutely fascinating. Well, I think first of all, there were a lot of people alive during World War II until recently, so that we could, when I for the Paris Library, I had interviewed three women who lived through the occupation. So it's really incredible to be able to have that firsthand
Yeah, for
knowledge
sure.
of these women. And so that was no longer possible for World War I. I also think that World War II is more black and white, where we can say Nazis bad, allies good. We can't really say explicitly what happened in World War I, why this assassination by this 17-year-old kid of the Archduke, why that had such a huge impact all over Europe.
But I love that you've discovered this story because it seems so much of World War I fiction and non-fiction is always about the soldiers in the trenches, which obviously was horrific and has rightly been discussed. But I had no idea a group of women from all around the world went and lived in a crumbling chateau to kind of help resurrect and restore a devastated war-torn home. That's so, how did you find that story?
While I was researching my book, The Paris Library, I
Oh.
found this other librarian who in 1918 traveled to northern France in order to create something that did not exist in France yet, which was children's libraries. And so she created children's libraries, and five of them still exist in the north. One still exists in
Really?
Paris. It just celebrated its centennial. So yes, she just left an incredible legacy. She feminized the profession. I think before her, there was only one female archivist. She was named an archivist the year she died. So it's kind of a bittersweet story. So yes, so she feminized the profession. She created children's libraries. Before, there were not stacks that you could go into. People could not access the books. They could tell a civil servant what they wanted, and the civil servant would try to find it. But there was no Dewey Decimal System. There was no way books were organized by their size or the day they arrived at the library. So there was really no way to find them
But this
unless
is
you
not
live
just
near
a story,
nearby.
it's like a social commentary. There's a real history of the library service in here.
Well, and there's an exchange of ideas, definitely, because there were English women, American women, and French women, so they really learned from each other. And then when the foreigners went home, they took the knowledge that they learned in France, and they took it back to England and to America. So it was really incredible to see that
It
as
seems
well.
quite enlightened for its time, doesn't it? Because when you tend to think of that period, in the 20th century, it does feel quite patriarchal. It's quite kind of mired in, sort of male-dominated profession. But to think of these groups of women from France and America all coming and England coming together like that's amazing.
Yes, it really is.
Feels
And
quite
then you think,
anachronistic as well, doesn't it, for its time?
well, and there was the group, is it Fanny, Fanny,
Oh
you know, that came over, and the English army didn't want them, but the Belgian army was very happy to have their help. And so several of the Fannies from England, after the war was over, they worked for Card in northern France. And so it was, yes, there was one named Phyllis Puckle that I researched, and she was so interesting. She was one of the drivers. They called themselves, instead of chauffeur, they called them the feminine chauffeurs, and she was one of them. It was absolute delight to
And
research
what was
her.
her name? Phyllis
Phyllis Puckle.
Puckle. That's a great name, isn't
It
it?
really is.
That in a way not a hindrance, but because you had this ready-made cast of very strong characters, did that help or hinder you? Because how much of the true story do you weave in? How much do you leave out? How much are you paying homage to them? It's a delicate line to walk, isn't it?
I find it very challenging because I know for a fact that my character, whose name is Jessie Carson, never said the word I have several of her reports and several of the speeches that she read out, and she never takes credit for anything that was done, even though she was the motor. And in the correspondence between the president and vice president of Card, it says that if Jessie Carson had left, the whole library service would have crumbled. And yet she never put herself first, or she never took credit. She always gave credit to the whole team. And it was really, so I have her on the page as maybe quite shy, maybe too shy. And so I think it can be a problem when you're working with a real life character, because you still have to bring them to life, and you really have to make them interesting.
And don't you think, as you're saying that, it reminds me of quite a few wartime women that I've interviewed, like particularly one, a lady who was a doctor during World War II, and she said it was never I but we. And she was just so like that. You never bragged and you never put yourself up as, it just wasn't the done
Exactly.
thing.
Exactly. So yes, it's very hard. And so I feel my character not wanting to be in the limelight, and I'm putting her in the limelight.
So for you, the interpretation of real characters is always open to interpretation, obviously, because these characters are long dead, and it is fiction. You are writing historical fiction, but you sort of, again, you I feel like there's a slight duty of care to these women from the past, but
Absolutely.
at the same
Yes.
time, it is my interpretation of it, of the past. So you almost have to give yourself permission to enjoy writing those characters.
Well, and you know, I started writing my book, The Paris Library, in the point of view of the directress, Dorothy Reader. And it was very hard for me to put words in her mouth. And so I created the character, the fictional character, Odile, who was the storyteller.
So she was your character, and you could have
Yes,
carte
and
blanche to do with her.
so I didn't feel so bad about creating her the way I wanted to.
And I like that. I think that's a good mix because in my book, I had Mrs. Cholmondeley, who was this real character, who was a real woman, but I didn't want to have her as a central character. I didn't want to assume to put words in her mouth because she struck me as a woman that would have her very own definite opinions. So having Clara and Ruby, you have that kind of creative license almost, don't you? But I love the weaving in of real characters, because then when you're reading it and then you go off down the Google hole, you think, oh, okay, and then you start to re do your Googling and realize that woman was real and that woman's real. For me, it's fascinating that that's the best way to bring history to life. Just tell me a little bit about your routine, Janet. How do you work? How do you have a routine, or is every day different?
It's
I know it depends on what
really
phase you're in.
hard. The last few years, I think it's been really hard. I used to get up at 5 in the morning and
Did
then that's
you?
really the quiet time. And just the last few years, just life has kind of gotten in the way where there's been a lot of
Well, because the
different
book did so
stressors.
well, you're suddenly propelled into the public eye, aren't you?
No, I think it's just, with COVID and the aftermath, and I think everybody's gone through hard times or have had, loved ones with health issues or deaths or, things like that. So it's just been a hard time. And so I don't know. I don't think I'm sleeping as well. So I'm not getting up as I usually do. And that's too bad because it's really my creative time. I think that's when
Is
I'm
it 5 a.m.
like the
really?
most alert. And so if I could go back to that, I would. I also have an upstairs neighbor who's really noisy.
Oh no.
So it's really hard to, like, I can't go to sleep until he goes to sleep, because it's just, the scraping of the furniture, the pounding of the feet, and
Oh, that's the thing with Paris, isn't it? Everybody sort of lives on top of another of one another, I suppose. And there are quite old buildings with thin floors, aren't they?
exactly. Yeah.
Oh, don't, but well, you've. I'm ashamed to have a very rose-tinted, slightly cliched image of you strolling down by, past the Eiffel Tower with a baguette under your arm. I'm sure it's absolutely nothing like that. How, and you've lived in Paris for quite a while now. Do you feel like a Parisian?
I think so. I think it's easy to come here from somewhere else because there's so many people from different places. I don't know if that's true of all of France, but I think in Paris, it's definitely easy
Yeah.
to feel at home here, to kind of find the things that you like to do. And I definitely feel there's a bookshop I love called the Red Wheelbarrow
Oh, where's that?
Bookshop. It's right across from the Luxembourg Gardens. So I just that's my happy place. So you'll
Is it?
definitely find me strolling there.
So if you want to find Janet, go to the Red Barrow bookshop. Did you just stumble upon that? Is that one of your favorite places?
No, it's existed in different forms for about 20 years, and the proprietor's a Canadian bookseller.
Okay.
So if she moved, she was in the Marais, kind of more in the middle of town, and now she's moved spots, and so it's a different bookshop now, but that same wonderful atmosphere.
Oh, I'm dying to go back to Paris. I long to go back there. And when I do, that is good. It's definitely
Yeah,
on my
let me
list of
know when
places
you're
to
to the Red
visit.
Wheelbarrow. Yes, thank you.
Because last time I went, I took my son, who was at the time 10, and he had a very definite list of what he wanted to do. He wanted to see Napoleon's grave for some reason, which is in the Museum d'Invalides. It's the army
Yes,
museum with
I
that
know that
beautiful
there.
gold. Yeah.
Yes, my character in this new book, her name is Anne Morgan. She was the richest woman in the world. She has a plaque at Les Invalides,
No,
and
really.
she was a commander of the Legion of Honor and was one of the first women to be one of the commanders of the Legion of Honors. And on the plaque it says that she's an intrepid and generous friend of France, and it's at the Invalides. So it's, yeah, I think,
Oh,
yeah, it's a place to go for
amazing.
sure. I think your son was right.
Oh yeah,
It's a place to go.
he I was a bit sort of like, why are we going there? But when we went there, it is a beautiful place with that enormous gold dome. And we went in, and of course, Napoleon's grave is, or a monument is as you'd expect. And we sort of stood there looking at it. And I said, why do you think? I said, look at it. And he said, oh, he's trying to make himself closer to God. I was like, wow, that's quite profound. But yeah, it was a very moving place. And I think we also went, where else did we go? To the catacombs, deep, deep below. Have you been there?
I went there with, I was teaching 10-year-olds in the public school here, and so it was a class trip. And I don't think I would have gone on my own, but the children were so fun. They were kind of giggly and scared, and so it made it for a really fun
Yeah.
family
Oh,
time.
that's such a deeply evocative place, isn't it? All the walls lined with skulls and oh, creepy. Anyway, I could go on for ages about Paris and my favorite places. But Janet, I always ask interviewees the same sort of three questions to pay off. What was your favorite childhood book growing up? If you had to narrow it down to one, I appreciate that's difficult.
But I think I would say Charlotte's Web by E.B. White, or Laura Ingalls Wilder, the books by Laura Ingalls Wilder, when she was a child, as a young pioneer. So I think they're beautiful books, but there are so many beautiful books that I love to read as a child.
Yeah, same. Children's books were outstanding, aren't they, as well? Many of the books that I read that are still classics today. What, and where would you get these books from? Did you have a childhood library that you used to go to, or what, where do you remember growing
My
up like?
parents always, when we went, we lived an hour and a half away from the big city. So when we went to the big city, they would give me $5. And when we'd go to the bookstore, and that would buy two books. So that was very exciting for me. But we also went to the library. My mother drove my grandmother, who never learned to drive, to places every week, the grocery store and the library. And so we often went to the library, and it's my favorite place in town. It's just really lovely.
And do you think those visits to the library, what do you think made you, do you think you were born a writer? Or do you think that childhood reading helped shape those ambitions? I'm always fascinated, like, why writers become writers. Do you think we're born that way?
I don't know if we're born that way. I learn of a lot of people who become writers when they're 50 or 60 years old, which is always in, after a big, very different career. But I knew I was a writer when I was 12. I knew this is
Really?
what I wanted to do. Yes, I had my journals. I was reading and writing poetry. Absolutely.
Yeah, because there's nothing else that you can do. It's like an outpouring, isn't it? Yeah.
I enjoy teaching, and I was the programs manager, where I invited authors to give talks and things like that. I like doing something else and then coming back to the page.
So, Jen, if you were sent off to a desert island with only one book, what would it be?
I love the book Bel Canto by Ann Patchett. It is a masterpiece. It's a modern masterpiece. I think it won the Orange Prize in
Oh, I
England
haven't
several
read
years
that.
ago. Oh, it's gorgeous.
Is it?
Absolutely gorgeous. And she shows how disparate people can come together, and how we're not so different after all. It's gorgeous, and she's got that wry sense of humor. I
Oh,
highly
perfect.
recommend
What a
it.
great suggestion. I'm going to try
What
that.
about you? What book would you take?
Oh, I don't know. I really have puzzled long and hard over this. I think this could be a book that you don't mind rereading, or you find something different in every time. I love Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier. Yeah, I think I'd probably take that one because it's the one I kind of, as soon as I open the, and the opening page, those classic words when you step through the doors into Manderley, I feel a relaxation come over me. I think it's just something that you just know you're going to love. But there are so many books that I still have to read. This is the joy of this podcast is speaking to other authors like yourself and hearing all their favorite books. My TBC list is ridiculous, but that's my only panic. There's just not enough time to read all the books. But Janet, thank you so much because I know
So
you're in the
much for
middle of
having me.
a big edit. So it's been an absolute joy to have you on here. And I cannot wait to read the new book.
Oh, well, thank you. I feel the same. We'll have to do an exchange.
Yeah, for sure. Definite. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I really hope that you enjoyed that conversation. If you have any questions or comments about any of the topics raised in our conversation, or perhaps you have a story you'd like to share, then do get in touch via my website, Facebook, or Instagram, details of which are all listed on the podcast. Thanks for listening.